The headlines: Iran says it is duty bound to take revenge for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by the U.S. in 2020. The Syrian military says it has intercepted a new Israeli strike on the capital, Damascus, shooting down most of the enemy's missiles. And the U.S. Congressional Committee probing the assault on the Capitol Hill says Donald Trump should be held accountable for a gross dereliction of presidential duty. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's foreign minister says revenge for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is the absolute responsibility of foreign ministry and other concerned organizations. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the assassination will never be forgotten. He said a special committee at the foreign ministry follows the international legal investigation into the case, and the judiciary branch is also seriously pursuing the matter. Amir Abdullahian said an Iranian ambassador who previously served at the UN has been appointed as the official in charge of the following legal case in the international level. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was martyred by the U.S. drone strike near the capital, Baghdad International Airport, on January 2020.
Iran's anti-terrorism icon was assassinated by the United States military in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, on January the 3rd. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the highest-ranking commander of the Quds Force in Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Soleimani played a key advising role in strengthening resistance movements across the region. The commander took part in different battlefields to lead resistance fighters. A quiet, charismatic man, a strategic genius, and a tactical operator who spent most of his life in combat. Soleimani first set foot on a battlefield in the 1980s when the fledgling Islamic Republic of Iran came under attack by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Soleimani was at the time a young man in his 20s, fighting tirelessly to defend Iranian soil against the aggressor. After 8 years of the war, Soleimani emerged battle-tested and battle-hardened. He became a national hero and a beloved commander in the IRGC. Soleimani and the forces under his command soon became one of the instrumental players in combating terrorism in Iran's southeastern areas and in Afghanistan. But the most important chapter of his military career started when he became the chief commander of the IRGC's Quds Force in 1998. General Soleimani strongly supported the Palestinian cause. He spared no effort to strengthen the Hezbollah resistance movement in Lebanon. During the 33-day war between Israel and Lebanese resistance fighters in 2006, General Soleimani went to Lebanon to oversee the battle against the Israeli regime. The fight against the Daesh terrorist group probably marked the climax of his anti-terror endeavors. During the tough campaign against Daesh, he was often seen in battlefields in Iraq and Syria. General Soleimani was the brain behind the operations that paralyzed the monster terror group and rolled back its advances. Soleimani has long been a household name in Iran and many regional countries. His presence in the battle against terrorism gave people a sense of security. It's now definitely tough for them to deal with his loss. People in Iraq and Iran are still mourning the loss of their anti-terror icon. Soleimani's funeral processions have become a symbol of unity. Following the US assassination, regional resistance groups have pledged to remain steadfast to his path. The general is no longer among us, but his martyrdom seems to have given fresh blood to the resistance front.
Israel has carried out a fresh airstrike on Syria, killing three soldiers and injuring seven others. The Syrian Defense Ministry has confirmed the attack. It says the air raid targeted an area near the capital and caused material damage. It says Syria's air defense managed to intercept some of its missiles. The Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks on Syria, mainly targeting its military and resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Syria has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies for violating its sovereignty. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond to the Israeli aggression. The Iranian president has hosted his Turkish and Russian counterparts for a summit on the crisis in Syria. As much as Syria was the focus of the gathering, there was another positive result to come out of the summit: how Iran, Russia, and Turkey can solve regional issues. One of the challenges discussed was how to convince Turkey not to pursue its military operation against Kurds in northern Syria, and that is what Iran's leader conveyed to the Turkish president.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria, and the entire region, and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-à-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognized there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The Astana process has been an ongoing trilateral cooperation meant to solve the Syrian crisis that has been dragging on because of the U.S. and its allies' hostility against the Syrian government. Now, the only remaining parties that illegally remain in Syria are the U.S. and the terrorists. Damascus has accused Washington of plundering Syrians' national resources, including its oil, while the Syrians are under U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Turkey has accused the U.S. of supporting terrorists. Iran has said the U.S. is the source of instability in Syria.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia, and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Принятым совместным заявлением подтверждена приверженность укреплению трехстороннего сотрудничества России, Ирана и Турции в интересах достижения устойчивой и жизнеспособной нормализации ситуации в Сирийской Арабской Республике.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the US out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the US is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
A U.S. House committee investigating the 2021 attack on the Capitol Hill says a former President Donald Trump should be held accountable for a gross dereliction of his presidential duty.
He commanded a mob he knew was heavily armed, violent, and angry, to march on the Capitol to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power. These facts have gone undisputed, and so there needs to be accountability. Accountability under the law, accountability to the American people. He recklessly blazed a path of lawlessness and corruption, the cost to which democracy be damned.
That the stuff that his people were shuffling at.
During the eighth hearing of the probe, the top aides of a former president gave out their testimonies. A witness said Donald Trump spent nearly 3 hours in a private room watching the attack unfold and ignored his advisor's call to take action. The panel plans to reconvene for more hearings in September. The former president's supporters attacked Congress when lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden's victory on January 6, 2021. The mob caused the death of 5 people. And mortgage holders in the Eurozone are forced to make higher repayments as the European Central Bank increases the interest rates by 0.5%. Eurozone inflation is running at 8.6% when the ECB's target was just 2%. Jerome Hughes reports.
There are many in the 19-country Eurozone who are barely managing to survive, let alone live. Even for those who have jobs, the cost of living is taking its toll. Mortgage holders will now be paying more as interest rates are going up by 0.5 percentage points.
We have to bring inflation down to 2% in the medium term. That is the imperative under the treaty. That is the strategy review objective that we have set for ourselves. And it's time to deliver.
In times of financial difficulty, young people are disproportionately impacted.
It's mental health. It's a lot of issues that we need to look into.
We can't trust anyone. We can't trust government. We can't trust education system.
We need money to get our life starting, like a car, a house.
Sanctions against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine have pushed up energy and food prices. There will be political consequences, and experts say that makes it harder for the EU to function.
That is the biggest danger of it, that you have increasing political problems which make member states unable to find compromises.
Some EU lawmakers warn of widespread strike action in the coming months because pay is not keeping up with inflation. It has been suggested that efforts by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to reduce EU gas consumption will have a detrimental impact on the most financially vulnerable, as the move could push up prices even more. A number of prominent economists and political scientists have claimed von der Leyen might well end up being the last European Commission president, suggesting if the Eurozone slips into another prolonged recession, the EU will not survive. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has stepped down after his coalition collapsed. The resignation now casts a pall of uncertainty over the future of the Italian government, which is facing high inflation and grappling with an energy crisis.
On Thursday, Mario Draghi tendered his resignation as Prime Minister to President Sergio Mattarella after a coalition supporting his government of national unity collapsed. Addressing the lower house, the resigning Prime Minister thanked the parliamentarians present, most of whom had supported his executive over the last 17 months.
Certe volte anche il cuore dei banchieri centrali.
Thanks for your support. Sometimes even the hearts of central bankers get used. Thank you for all the work done in this period.
Draghi quit after three major parties in his broad coalition, namely the Five Star Movement, the League and Forza Italia, boycotted a confidence vote in the Senate on a resolution backing the former president of the European Central Bank. Draghi's decision to resign paves the way for a period of high political uncertainty in Italy.
In una situazione internazionale estremamente delicata.
Ours is a complicated situation. We have now a fragile government in a highly unstable international scenario and under the pressure of effectively spending the money from the recovery fund. Italy is facing mounting economic and inflationary pressures. It's a situation of grave risk.
With the dissolution of the Italian parliament, the outgoing government will stay in office for everyday administration until snap elections are held.
In an unprecedented move, snap elections could take place as early as late September, a time when the government needs to prepare to pass its budget. According to polls, a coalition led by the far-right Brothers of Italy, and which includes the League and Berlusconi's Forza Italia, could win an outright majority in the next elections.
In a surprise move, the day after Draghi's resignation and for the first time since 2011, on Thursday the European Central Bank raised interest rates by 0.5 percentage points, while economists had expected a smaller 0.25-point hike. Some financial analysts have seen that as a warning to highly indebted Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
نقيم الدين ولا تتفرق فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
ولقد يسرنا القرآن للذكر فهل من مدكر
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we completed explanation of Surah Waqi'ah, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Hadid, which is number 57 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 29 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. It mentions the heavy metallic element called iron as being sent down by God to endow the earth itself with mighty force and provide humanity with the many benefits of its structural strength, as well as all the great tests of faith that arise from this. It takes its name from Ayah 25, which mentions Hadid, that is iron. The opening ayahs present several divine attributes. Then the surah proceeds with the grandeur of the Noble Quran, the state of believers and hypocrites on the day of resurrection, accounts of the past nations and spending in the way of Allah for establishment of social justice. It criticizes monasticism and social seclusion and mentions the response received from the public by the previous prophets, such as Noah, Abraham, and Jesus, peace upon them. The surah closes with a reference to the people of the book. Interesting merits are mentioned concerning the recitation of Surah Hadid, such as the prophet saying that the reciter of this surah will be counted from among the staunch believers. It should, however, be noted that recitation must be accompanied by proper reflection on its contents and putting them into practice. First, we invite you to listen to ayahs 1, 2, and 3 of Surah Hadid.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Sabbaha lillahi ma fis samawati wal ardi wa huwal azizul hakim. Lahu mulkus samawati wal ardi yuhyi wa yumitu wa huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir. هو الأول والآخر والظاهر والباطن وهو بكل شيء عليم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, whatever there is in the heavens and the earth glorifies Allah, and He is the Almighty, the All-Wise. To Him belongs the kingdom of the heavens and the earth. He gives life and brings death, and He has power over all things. He's the first and the last, the manifest and the hidden, and he has knowledge of all things. The Arabic phrase of the opening ayah, Sabbaha lillah, means glory to God Almighty, is in past verbal form according to grammatical rules and goes on to say that everything in the heavens and the earth glorifies Allah. This particular phrase also marks the opening surahs Hashr and Saf, which are numbered 59 and 61 respectively. Two other surahs, that is Jum'ah and Taghabun, which are numbered 62 and 64, start with the phrase Yusabbih lillah, which is in present verbal form and conveys the same meaning. Glorification of God by each and everything means that even the tiniest atom has some sense of perception, which is beyond the little knowledge we humans have managed to acquire through trial and error. In other words, the wonderful world of creation, which functions in an orderly manner without any haphazard occurrences, is based on divine wisdom and indicates the infinite power of God, who is glorified and praised by each created thing, even the seemingly inanimate objects. Sovereignty of the realms of the earth and the heavens belongs to the one and only Creator, who grants life and decrees death, and everything is in His possession. Ayah 3 indicates delicate expressions regarding the divine attributes of the first and the last, and the manifest and the hidden, which reflect God's pre-eternality and everlastingness. In other words, He is the necessary being who has neither origin nor end, but He is pre-eternal and everlasting. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, each and every creature, including the tiniest atom, has some sense of perception of the Almighty Creator and glorifies Him. Number two, God is the real sovereign of the entire universe, which means all other ownerships are transitory and unreal and should not make us proud. And number three, both life and death are decreed by God, the pre-eternal and the everlasting. Now let us listen to ayahs 4, 5, and 6 of the same surah.
هو الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يعلم ما يلج في الأرض وما يخرج منها وما ينزل من السماء وما يعرج فيها وهو معكم أينما كنتم والله بما تعملون بصير له ملك السماوات والأرض وإلى الله ترجع الأمور يولج الليل في النهار ويولج النهار في الليل وهو عليم بذات الصدور.
It is He who created the heavens and the earth in six stages, then settled on the throne. He knows whatever enters the earth and whatever emerges from it, and whatever descends from the sky and whatever ascends to it. And He is with you wherever you may be. and Allah sees best what you do. To Him belongs the kingdom of the heavens and the earth, and to Allah all matters are returned. He makes the night pass into the day, and makes the day pass into the night, and He knows best what is in the breast. According to the Noble Quran, the wonderful universe has been created in six stages, which means periods of time that are unknown to us, since the counting of our years is limited to the planet Earth's revolving around the sun, similar to other planets of the solar system whose years, whether shorter or longer, depends on their own particular orbits. Thus, the six stages or periods of creation mentioned in Ayah 4 are not based on the years of our planet. Allah the Almighty is far glorious to have any form, shape, or place. Hence, the phrase, settled on the throne, refers to His absolute sovereignty and His all-encompassing power over the entire universe. As the Creator, He is aware of each and everything in the entire universe, including the number of the minutest insects, the orbits of the billions of stars, the raindrops that fall on the earth, the vapors that ascend towards the atmosphere, and all animate or inanimate objects, as well as thoughts that flash across our minds. He is nearest to every one of us than our own jugular veins, and yet unseen, since eyes cannot perceive Him, although we feel His love and compassion in our hearts. His sovereignty covers the heavens and the earth, including whatever they possess, since it is He who is the all-wise Creator, to whom everything returns. It is the infinite power of Allah that makes the earth rotate on its axis while revolving around the sun, thus ensuring adequate hours of daylight and darkness that vary as per the seasons and evolve into months and years, while providing the exact amount of light and darkness necessary for human life as well as growth of plants. Nothing is hidden from the Creator, who is fully aware of whatever one harbors in his or her hearts and chests. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, creation and its duration are based on divine wisdom. Number two, God is aware of all and everything in the universe world. Number three, sovereignty belongs to God alone. And number four, the days and nights are clear examples of God's orderly administration. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 7, 8, and 9 of Surah Hadid.
آمنوا بالله ورسوله وأنفقوا مما جعلكم مستخلفين فيه فالذين آمنوا منكم وأنفقوا لهم أجر كبير وَمَا لَكُمْ لَا تُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَالرَّسُولُ يَدْعُوكُمْ لِتُؤْمِنُوا بِرَبِّكُمْ وَقَدْ أَخَذَ مِيثَاقَكُمْ إِن كُنتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ هو الذي ينزل على عبده آيات بينات ليخرجكم من الظلمات إلى النور وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ بِكُمْ لَرَؤُوفٌ رَحِيمٌ.
Have faith in Allah and His Prophet, and spend out of that wherein He has made you successors of the past generations. Those of you who have faith and spend in Allah's way, there is a great reward for them. Why should you not have faith in Allah while the Prophet invites you to have faith in your Lord, and He has certainly made a covenant with you should you be faithful? It is He who sends down manifest signs to His servants that He may bring you out of darkness into light, and indeed Allah is most kind and merciful to you. Faith in God and obedience to His commandments, as elaborated by the Prophet, is not mere lip service, but should be embedded in the heart in order to become manifest through actions, such as spending in God's way, including from what one has inherited from the predecessors. There are untold rewards for those who spend in the way of Allah, since whatever we possess are merely trust that should not be squandered, and whatever is left should be passed to posterity. It is worthy of note that belief is valuable when it is accompanied by helping the needy, and such expending is valuable when it arises from belief in God Almighty and obedience to the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Disbelievers are reproached for not having believed in the Prophet's call to have faith in Allah, despite being shown clear proofs, signs, and manifest miracles. Allah's covenant is for all believers. The Noble Quran, revealed to the Prophet of Islam as the last heavenly scripture, is the book of guidance that shows light to the seekers of truth, and those eager to come out of the darkness of ignorance will indeed find God as the most merciful. These ayahs teach us that, number one, mere expression of faith in God has no value without practical display of what the Prophet has taught, including helping the poor and the needy. Number two, prophets are God's emissaries for guiding people towards salvation. Number three, the Noble Quran saves people from ignorance, polytheism, and superstition. And number four, guidance through prophets and heavenly scripture, such as the Noble Quran, are among the best signs of God's mercy for mankind.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Ukraine is moving full steam ahead. One of the developments, energy warnings from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, who has said that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely. Then there's a warning from the former Russian President Medvedev that an attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Meanwhile, several high-profile suspensions have taken place in Ukraine, while Russia is targeting Ukraine's missiles as Western-supplied weapons bite. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joins us from Moscow. Then we have the president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, let me first start with you. The former Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, has issued a warning that I thought would set the stage for this program, in which he said attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very hard, very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Tell us, give us context of that and what he's talking about, what he means.
Well, I think the key here is the American threat to provide long-range missiles. They're providing these multiple launch missiles, you know, the HIMARS they're called, with shorter ranges, like 30 to up to 70 kilometers. But there is a version of this weapon system that has missiles that go up to 300 kilometers. And the Ukrainians have explicitly threatened to use them against Crimea. And their, Crimea is, besides its symbolic importance to Ukraine, it is a target-rich environment. It has the Russian naval base at Sevastopol and several key military zones. So I think this threat is something the Russians take pretty seriously. And I'm guessing that warning is directed, not directly, but symbolically at Washington. They're trying to tell the Americans, don't supply this type of weaponry to the Ukrainians because it will be a major escalation. Otherwise, I don't know what Judgment Day might mean. I mean, the Russians do have the ability to destroy a lot of targets inside Ukraine, and they do, they are doing it. So, but Judgment Day is a religious term, and I don't really know what specific sort of escalation they're threatening. But it doesn't, it sounds chilling, that's for sure.
Mahmoud Rafat, I'll put this into context as to how some have been reporting this, in which Medvedev was said not to elaborate, but has previously warned the U.S., they've put it in this context, of the dangers of attempting to punish a nuclear power like Russia over its action in Ukraine. Do you think that the U.S. is pushing Russia's buttons to that point?
Well, obviously, the American side gave intelligence information about the places of the Russian generals, which caused killing 17 generals, and this started by direct orders or instructions from President Biden, which means, yes, there are somehow Americans pushing both Ukraine and Europeans against Russia, and not in a Russian way, because we have to also remember there is international law, and this international law gives Ukraine the right to the to join the NATO, but on the ground that's not feasible, especially for the Russian side, which they consider it big threat to the security, national security of Russia, and they would never admit it. So not only the international law will manage the case or the file in front of us today, but will be somehow powers who will talk in next few weeks, and we will see the escalation will arrive until which point if the American side continues supporting Kiev.
Well, not to just zoom in on this issue, but I think it's pretty important since we have opened up the program with it. And Fred Weir, I'm curious whether the U.S. has to discuss or get permission from other NATO members when it wants to, when it provides Ukraine with this HIMARS, what do you call it, a HIMARS missile system? Is that what it's called? Where it, as you said, has a 300-kilometer range? Because based on that, my next question then would be, what if one lands in Crimea, or two, or how many would it take for Russia to react?
This is
for Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The HIMARS system, it is one system, but it has different types of ammunition. They are already providing, the Americans are already providing these systems to Ukraine. They're already in action in the Donbass. Apparently, there are a dozen or so of them already in Ukraine. But that type of ammunition, which is the high-end, the long-range missiles, are not yet being provided. And it would be, I think it would be a step beyond for the Americans to do so, except that we've already had this exchange of opinions. The Ukrainians have said, we will target Crimea, which we consider to be Ukrainian territory, not Russian. And the United States, officially, I haven't got the quote to hand, but they did officially say that they wouldn't consider Crimea to be Russian territory because they have forbidden the Ukrainians to use these weapons against Russian territory. But both the United States and Ukraine doesn't consider Crimea Russian territory. Therefore, I think some sort of fix is in, and that in Washington they are contemplating this very escalation. And it would be pretty serious, as that quote, that rather obscure, vague quote from Medvedev clearly implies, the Russians would regard that as a serious escalation, and they would react in some way. And we don't know what that would be, but, everything like this draws us a little closer to World War III than we would like to be.
Sure. Well, Masoud Rafat, on the political side, within Ukraine, there was a development that was pretty strange in the way it was first presented and then retracted, in a sense, where President Volodymyr Zelensky was reported first abruptly firing the head of Ukraine's powerful domestic security agency called the SBU, then the state prosecutor general, in which it cited dozens of cases actually of collaboration with Russia by officials in those agencies. But then the news came out that they have been suspended pending investigations, not formally dismissed. What do you make of that development?
Well, I think there is somehow a contradiction in the behavior of President Zelensky, because he fired the top officials of intelligence and the prosecutor as well, general prosecutor of Ukraine, because there he accused them, or he said their employees are working for the Russian, which is considered enemy of Ukraine for the moment. While that cannot be applied on the ground, that cannot be imagined on the ground to happen, because these people, either they were blocked there or they were imprisoned or whatever we call their statute, but not working for Russian side. This is not imaginable even to work for the Russian side. But in my opinion, President Zelensky expected more investigation or more result of the war crimes and crimes against humanity, etc., of these chains of crimes the Kiev prosecution addressed to the Russian side. And both the intelligence service with the prosecution did not fulfill his wishes to gather as much as he wanted to present them to the International Criminal Court or to start with other Western governments this case, the case of crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity they accused Russia to had committed. In my opinion, this is the main reason, the failure of the two structures or two organizations to fulfill the wishes of President Zelensky in these cases.
How do you see that, Fred? Some are looking at this being maybe on a larger scale to happen because as the war drags on, as the country is suffering as immensely as it is, that you're going to see more dissent maybe in a sense to happen in Ukraine. Do you see this as a sign of that?
I think it's very worrisome.
No, this is Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry.
It's extremely worrisome. It's not just the two top officials who've been suspended. They haven't been accused of treason. But there are ongoing almost 700 treason cases in Ukraine. And this something Zelensky mentioned in his statement. There's 660 cases of treason within the state apparatus, the SBU, the military, other institutions. And there are 60 cases of officials in occupied territories who have gone to work for the Russians. This is totally believable, by the way. And I don't know about all the treason cases and so on. But you have a regime that is now clearly terrified of its own shadow. This scale of arrests for and treason charges is not a sign of a unified government in any way. So it's extremely worrisome, and it's the kind of thing that starts to get out of hand when you've got that many people clearly being suspected of treason and on trial, under arrest, and you've got police, secret police and others looking for such enemies. This kind of thing has a way of snowballing. It is really, really worrisome. I have no idea what is going on in Kyiv, but people should be paying much closer attention to it.
Well, there's another point of concern for Ukraine, Masoud Rafat, and that is whether it's going to continue getting the support that it has been. And I'm going to put these two developments into one, forge it into one for you, where there's one piece of news that talks about what it termed EU fatigue, where the EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell actually had to make a statement saying some European leaders have been saying that the sanctions were an error, they were a mistake, in which he says we don't think it was a mistake. And then you have the get-together of the foreign ministers just today to show that the bloc can maintain its financial and military support, pledging more support for Ukraine. Of course, this is as their own citizens are suffering. Do you think that there's fatigue within the EU countries for prolonging this war?
Well, for sure, there's a fatigue. We can not now. The exchange rate of the euro for first time in its history to fall down in front of the dollar and to lose big percentage of its value and to become less than even $1 today after it was like $1.20. This is a big sign of fatigue of the economy as well. We mustn't forget the most important point that the industry of Europe is really threatened and seriously threatened because of the suspension of Russian gas. Meanwhile, Russia is a big market for the European products. So there are on several levels. But we need to understand at the same time the kind of relation between Europe and the United States since the Second World War. Since the end of the Second World War, Europe did not build an army. Europe did not build real independency of the United States protection system. So when we talk about the NATO, we talk about United States decision. And it's very clear the administration of President Biden is insisting to continue the war with any price, to be from the European side or from the Russian side. And the Europeans will not be able to get out of this dilemma as long as the President Biden administration still, and we still have 3 years for this administration. So as long as the administration Biden is there, the war, I think, we will not be able to stop it, despite the fatigue and despite the consequences Europe is paying. We are feeling today, worldwide, maybe, but in Europe in particular, the increase, the dramatic increase of prices, the threat of industries, as I just mentioned, to be stopped because of the gas, lots of things we have in Europe. But Europe will not be able to dispatch from the United States decision because of the nature of the relationship since the end of the Second World War in 1945 until today, and will continue like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it remains to be seen how much of this relationship is going to continue in its bond. Because when you have a warning coming from the IEA, for example, Fred Weir, where European nations, it said, must take urgent action to avert a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch. And the biggest one that I could think of, Fred Weir, is the one that was issued by Germany, where even the government said that, people have to maybe cope to turn to wood as a heating source for this winter. And plus, we know that Nord Stream 1 is actually under repair, where Russia now says, if we want to open it back up, we need to talk about lifting of sanctions. How worried should Europe be?
Yes, very worried. There are so many aspects of these sanctions that have boomeranged. But on the energy front, that is the biggest single, I don't know what you'd call it, goal or something that the West has inflicted. It is remarkable that in the meeting you referenced today, they did not impose any new energy-related sanctions. It is clear that the winter is not that far away, and natural gas reservoirs are not anywhere near full, and therefore this is a problem that is focusing minds for sure right now. I don't know what this leads to. What I fear, to come back to your original question, I fear further escalations. Some news, you know how this happens. Some terrible thing happens, an atrocity, a huge war crime, something just comes up and completely changes the public atmosphere and ratchets up the confrontation. This is a very dangerous time, and it's not a static thing, this Ukraine fatigue or whatever. I think we're in the midst of a very fluid situation, one in which the standoff between Russia and the West can turn very nasty very quickly. And so I don't know, I wake up every morning in sheer terror of what I might find when I start reading the news.
So what's going to trigger that? I mean, since you spoke that way, what would trigger that World War III scenario?
Yeah, well, Ukrainians attacking Crimea with heavy missiles and the Russians retaliating in some way. Because what could the Russians do? They could retaliate against the NATO staging grounds where they're bringing weaponry into Ukraine, right on the border there. It seems likely that in recent attacks, the Russians have killed foreign officers. I don't think this is well noticed, but an attack on an officers' club in Vinnytsia the other day appears to have killed foreign military officers who were there consulting with their Ukrainian colleagues. This sort of thing, because NATO forces, especially Polish forces, are so much more involved in Ukraine and inside Ukraine, and on the border where weapons are being transported every day,